Today is October 4th, 2022. This is Zach Stein, Head of Special Collections at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, speaking with Ted Richard. Thank you very much. I guess my first question for you is, could you please describe what it was like growing up LGBTQ+ in Southwest Louisiana?
Sure. I guess we have to start with, I was born back in November of 1962. So I was in high school between the years of 76 to 1980. I really didn't come out until my senior year in high school. So my the way I grew up in the LGBTQ+ community then is totally different than the way it is now. Back then, I was still in the closet for most of my high school years. The closest I came to knowing a gay person was a good friend of mine got killed on his 16th birthday in a motorcycle accident. And I found out later that the person he was with on the motorcycle was his boyfriend. And it always traumatized me a bit that this guy was a really, really good friend of mine, and we were both gay, but we never had the guts to tell each other that we were gay. We didn't know, I don't even think we knew what the word was. We just knew that we liked men, but we didn't know what that meant, or we just knew that we were different in some way or another. I did know other people in my class that were gay, and they got the brunt of the ridicule and the insults and all of that, you know, being called faggot and queer and all of that stuff. You know, back then in the 70s, queer was a bad word. You know, when you call somebody queer, that was bad. I like the fact that the gay community has retaken that word to mean something more positive. But back then, that was not the case. I guess that's it on that. I did not get involved in the gay community as much as probably I wished I would have. Knowing what I know now, I wish that I would have been able to be more involved back then than I am now.
So, kind of follow up. So you mentioned you came out in your senior year. So, what was that experience like?
I guess that's a really tough question. The first time that I actually had gay sex was with a teacher of mine when I was in high school. Obviously, we kept that very much hush-hush and under the table. We didn't tell anybody because he could have lost his job or probably even gone to jail. But I was of age, and he was a young teacher. He was maybe only 25, 30 years old. So, I mean, it's not like I was being, you know, indoctrinated into the gay subculture of, you know, that kind of stuff. It wasn't that at all. It was something that I initiated. So I guess my high school teacher was the first person that I actually came out to, which was kind of cool in a way that, you know, that he knew my secret and nobody else knew. After him, I was dating this girl in high school who actually she and I are still best friends to this day. And we were out on a date, and it was about a month or so after my friend had died in that motorcycle accident. And that's when I told her, I said, look, I said, I think I'm gay. She said, oh, girl, she said, I already knew that. She said, I was waiting for you to find that, for you to figure it out, you know? So it's kind of one of those things where everybody, you think nobody knows, but everybody knows, and you're the only one that doesn't know that everybody else already knows, you know? So my coming out to my parents was a little bit different. I would have guys over and spend the night at the house, not sexual at all, just friends sleep over. And the way my parents found out that I was gay was, this was after I was out of high school. I was already living in Houston. Right after high school, I knew that I didn't want to stay in Lafayette. Lafayette was not the place for me. I needed a bigger city. So I moved to Houston in 1982. And my sister, who is 4 years younger than me, was getting berated and belittled in high school because she had a queer brother. So that's kind of how my parents found out, was because my sister was getting bullied in high school because of me. And the story that was told to me was that someone that she went to school with told her that they worked for a flower shop and that they delivered flowers to me at this gay bar. And I was there to take the flowers. That's how they knew that I was gay, because I accepted these flowers in a gay bar. Supposedly, I got a dozen roses. Well, to this day, in my entire life, I'm now almost 60 years old, I have never, ever received a dozen roses from anyone, ever. So I figured out that the guy that told her this was one of her classmates who had made up this whole story, because he had to figure out a way to figure out, he had to figure out a way to describe how he ended up in the gay bar, underage at that. So the whole story made no sense at all. But I've always known who this person was, and I never told her that I knew who this person was. Except, I know you know I wrote a book called The 16th Second. That's one of the chapters in the book, is about how I came out without even coming out. I call it the time I didn't come out, because really I didn't. Everybody came out for me. How I socialized in the gay community when I was back then, when I was still living in Lafayette and going back and forth to Houston, is I became a male stripper. And my male stripper name was Colt Michael. And I still go by that name sometimes. That's how I differentiate between who knows me as a stripper and who knows me as real Ted Richard. If you call me Mike or you call me Colt, I'll know, okay, that's where you know me from.
Where did that name come from?
No one's ever asked me that. The name came from, Colt was a dear friend of mine who lived in Houston, a guy named Colt Thomas. And I'd always liked that name for some reason, and it just stuck with me. And I said, but nobody would ever really be named that. And then I met this guy, and his name was Coulter, C-O-U-L-T-E-R, Coulter Thomas. And I said, wow, you know, somebody actually really is named that with a nickname of Colt. Michael is just a name that I came up with out of the blue. It doesn't reference anybody. It doesn't pertain to anybody. It's just a name that I liked. Like, if my name wouldn't have been Ted Anthony, it would have been Ted Michael. So it's just a name that I liked. And Colt Michael just stuck. It just stuck. And so when I was living in Lafayette, of course, everybody knew my real name was Ted Richard. That wasn't even a question. But when I went to Houston, because when I was still living in Lafayette, I would still go to Houston and perform in Houston a lot. Nobody knew my real name, you know. So that made it kind of, it was really, really cool for me. You know, I was working at JCPenney in the Northgate Mall, back when the Northgate Mall was the Northgate Mall. And I would go to Houston on the weekends and do my little stripper gig and all that. And I'd come back with all this money, and they'd be like, you're really doing well at JCPenney, right? And I'm like, yeah, let's go with that. Let's go with that.
Wow.
So yeah, but nobody ever asked me where I got the name from. But yeah, that's where I got the name from.
So what was, so you mentioned Dallas, or sorry, Houston, sorry.
Houston.
So what was that environment like? And did you only go there on the weekends, or?
The way I ended up in Houston was, there was a bar in Lafayette called Fantasy, the nightclub. It was a nightclub called Fantasy, and they had male strippers there one night, and I just absolutely fell in love with one of the strippers. Go figure, it would be me. And this is before I ever started dancing. This is before all of that stuff. So, I ended up meeting up with a stripper, and he took me to Houston for the weekend. We went back to Houston to his place, and I was still living in Lafayette, but I went to Houston for the weekend. And he introduced me to all kinds of people that, you know, in the stripper world, that really, really helped me out on my quest to become the next big male stripper in Houston. So,
what were some of the things that they, you know, taught you?
They taught me about perseverance. They taught me that I'm not always going to be the best. They taught me the most important thing was a dear, dear friend of mine named Naomi Sims. Naomi Sims is a former Miss Gay America, Miss Gay USA, Miss Gay Universe. She's won almost everything. And his real name was Newman Bro. And he's from St. Martinville. He died in the early 90s, unfortunately. But one of the things that he taught me was that there's a difference between friends and acquaintances. And you have to know the difference. And that always stuck with me, that, you know, you have friends and you have friends and you have acquaintances that are acquaintances, and you treat them as just that. And that's not to say that people that are acquaintances cannot somehow become friends, and how sometimes friends can down the road become mere acquaintances. But the difference is you have to be able to spot what the difference is and treat people accordingly. Because not everybody is your fan.
So as far as like difference between friend and acquaintance, how would you describe that?
Friends are people that I hang out with on a fairly frequent basis. People that know me, that have been to my home, that call me, not wanting anything, just call me to check on me. That's what friends are. Acquaintances are the people that you meet at the bar, the people that, and this is back when I was drinking, I used to drink a lot, you know, and you had bar friends. And that's all they were, was people that you would drink with. Well, those people are not really your friends. They're your acquaintances. You know, the people that tip you, they're your acquaintances. You know, you want them as a fan, but sometimes you don't want them in your life, in your personal life. You know, friends are people that you allow into your personal space. You know, acquaintances are the people that my professional image is what you see, and that's where you stop. That's probably not what you wanted to know, but...
Yeah. No, that's actually... No, actually, that was very interesting. So, I guess during this time, can you describe, like, just the cultural environment that you witnessed for LGBTQ plus individuals?
Yeah, you know, I'm going to speak about this from a standpoint of I've lived through this and now I'm on the other side of it. So I can better acquaint myself with what it was like back then. You know, and I guess that's the best way that I have to describe it, is that, you know, I had friends and I had acquaintances and I had people that I counted on, and people that counted on me. You know, we had those types of friendships back then. The people that I knew in the bar scene turned out to be friends of mine because we were all very, very close. But the one thing that we had all in common, the only thing that we all had in common, was that we were all gay. And that was a bond that made for a good bonding experience, because we knew that we could go nowhere else to have these conversations with other people. You know, and unlike what I think a lot of people think, you know, not all gay people sleep with each other. You know, people seem to have this misconception that that's, you know, everything about gay people is sexual, and it's not. I had to learn that, but it's not. You know, I wish that I would have been more supportive of the people that I knew was being bullied. Because I knew there were other guys being bullied, and I was never bullied like that. Because there was always a scapegoat. You know, I was never the target. There was always somebody else they could pick on. And I wish that I would have had the guts back then to stand up for some of those people that you know, I kind of regret that. I really do regret that. But, you know, in the Lafayette scene, you know, I became Mr. Royal Order of Unicorn. You know, I was pretty well known in the gay community back in Lafayette. But I was also really well known in Houston. More so than I ever was in Lafayette, which is kind of weird. Because, you know, you would think in Lafayette, you're kind of a big fish in a small pond. In Houston, I was a small fish in a big pond, but still I was more recognized there in Houston than I was ever in Lafayette. Until recently. But right. We'll get into that later.
You talked about how you did stripping work in Houston.
Yes.
Did you do it in Lafayette as well?
I did it in Lafayette as well. Yeah, that's where I started off in Lafayette. Let me rephrase that. I started off in Houston. I tried to get a gig dancing in Lafayette, and I was told by one of the bar owners that, number one, I wasn't good enough, and number two, nobody wanted to see me naked. So I was like, well, So when I started dancing in Houston and I won the Shirt of the Year contest in Houston, I came back to that same bar owner and I said, am I good enough now? And that's what it was. It wasn't that he thought that I wasn't good enough. He thought that I'm a local guy. You know, people would pay to see strippers from Houston or Dallas or Las Vegas. You know, they'll pay to bring strippers in, you know, or any kind of entertainment, whether it's strippers or drag queens or whatever. You bring people in from out of town, people, you know, gather to want to go see this phenomenal performer. But I was this phenomenal performer that already lived here. So I didn't have the same following that somebody from out of town would have had.
So would you say it was more like you had more success in Houston and Lafayette, or was it?
Yeah. Yeah. In the beginning, I had more success in Houston. I never knew. God, I hate to use the word famous, but that's kind of what it is. I never knew how well-known and well-respected I was as a stripper until I was living in Houston, and I brought some strippers. They wanted some strippers in Lafayette. So I brought some strippers that I knew from Houston. I brought them over with me to Lafayette to do a show. And they did the whole show. Everything was fine. And at the end of the show, one of the dancers came back and said, Mr. Ted, you got to come. You have to perform. I'm like, no. I said, I didn't bring anything. I'm not performing. I brought y'all. He said, you got to come listen to this. And they were chanting, we want Colt Michael. We want Colt Michael. And I'm like, holy cow. You know, I had no idea that the reason they all came was to see me, not the other three strippers that I had brought. And they were disappointed that I wasn't even going to show. So anyway, so one of the other dancers had an extra costume that I was able to wear. Thank goodness I was able to wear it. And they started the music for me, and I made like over $400 or $500 in tips in that one song. And I was like, holy cow, like, I felt the love, but I felt the respect that I always thought that I was missing in Lafayette. And I finally felt it then. So like I said, I try to steer away from the word famous, but that was the first time that I knew, oh my God, like, these people know me. They know who I am, and they know what I do, and they know what I can do.
Nice. Sort of going back to the cultural environment, yeah, you mentioned how you were never actually a target of it.
Right.
Did you, I guess, did you witness, like, and you mentioned, like, bullying and stuff. What did this entail? Like, was there, like violence or harassment or...
I saw straight people throw beer cans at the drag queens, you know, just things like that. Unfortunately, this is difficult to say, but the most bullying that I saw was within the gay community itself. People being, you know, either you're not acting straight enough, or you're acting too feminine, or, you know, or you're not like the rest of us, you know, like, it was kind of sad. It was kind of sad to watch. You know, because, like, it's just like in the straight community. People don't like you if you're a little bit mentally disabled, if you're a little bit too short, if you're too tall, if you're too skinny. Too skinny was the worst. You know, too fat. You know, those, you know, chubby chasers. Or, you know, it's just... people, that's the thing that I found most distraught about going out to the gay clubs, was that there was discrimination within the gay community. And I'm like, hold up, like, we're supposed to all be in the same boat here. You know, and so, as for anything specific, I can't name anything specific like that, other than seeing straight people throw beer cans at the drag queens, but they were kind of used to it, I guess, you know, but... you know, and that's the other thing, is some people love drag, some people hate drag. You know, if you did drag, people liked you or they didn't like you. It was just, I distraught is just the best way that I could surmise it. That it just made me kind of sad.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, did you see, like, that kind of infighting as? Did you see this sort of, like, Like, where do you think that came from?
It was a seniority kind of thing. Mm. Like, you know, now I'm one of the older gays. Back then, I was one of the younger gays. And, you know, there's this ageism thing, and there always is, and there probably always will be. You know, that, you know, I'm not one of the young studs anymore. I'm one of the older generation now. But back then, I was one of the young studs. So I got accolades and recognition that other people who didn't look like me got, you know, which was unfair to the others. You know, not only unfair to me, but unfair to the others, too. That, you know, what do you mean? Like, you know, you get treated a certain way because you look a certain way. And that just didn't sit right with me. Mm-hmm. Of course, I was the beneficiary of a lot of those accolades, too. So it's kind of like I'm being hypocritical by saying that, but that's the way it happened. That's the way it happened. I don't know how to describe it any other way than that.
Mm-hmm. Do you still see some of this, or do you think it's gotten better?
I think ageism still exists. Yes, definitely. Most definitely. I think that people still are attracted to the pretty people, whoever the pretty people think they are. I don't know who the pretty people are these days. I don't know. One of the things we'll get into later was when we were talking about Acadiana Pride, that, you know, then when I took over Acadiana Pride, it was like, the ageism just went away. It's like even the young kids, they were like, how do I get involved? What do I need to do? Da, da, da. You know, it was all of this. But I mean, you go into any gay bar, even today, in any gay bar, and you will see the divisions. You'll see the cliques inside the bar. All you have to do is walk in, and you will notice this clique over here and this clique over here. And you'll notice that the gays aren't supportive of the lesbians because they don't like the lesbians. And it's the same thing. Really, sadly, not much has changed. I want to tell you that it has, but sadly, I don't think so. I don't know why, but I don't think it has.
Okay. All right. Excuse me. So can you describe your experiences during the AIDS crisis and how the political climate in Acadiana changed?
Yeah. When I tested positive for HIV, I was living in Houston, client number 026415. And I tell you that number because it's etched in my brain. Because back then, you went to get some blood drawn, and they just told you, they called you on the phone if you tested positive. If you didn't get a phone call, then you were negative. If you got a phone call, then you were positive. And they posted it in the local newspaper.
Really?
Not your name, just your number. So that way, if you tested, you needed to know your number. And if your number is 026415, well, then you tested positive. You need to call your doctor right away. So I went to get tested with an ex-boyfriend of mine, who we remained friends even after we broke up. And this was a boyfriend that I had in Houston. And we went to get tested, and he got a phone call. And his phone call said, you need to come back in so that we could retest you so we could be sure. Well, be sure what? Well, we know what be sure means. So I never told him, but I got the same phone call. So we both tested positive at the same time. But I never told him, because I figured he was dealing with enough on his own, and I didn't want to be like, oh, well, guess what? I tested positive too. You know, I didn't want to be that friend, you know, that made it all about me instead of about him. So I was like, you know, that's it. And the AIDS crisis in Houston was horrendous. Horrendous. I lived in a gay complex called Westmoreland Square, and it was all gays. You know, and speaking of discrimination, it was mostly all white gays. Mm. I didn't see it at the time, but looking back, I'm like, well, holy crap. That was kind of a racist thing to do. But yeah, it was all, there was maybe, I think there was one black person, one Hispanic person, and one Jewish person that I knew. Everybody else was white men. Right? I'm like, looking back on it now, like, that's damn racist. But I lived there, so I can't, you know, I can't say it was, you know, it wasn't what it wasn't. So, but the horror of living there was we got to see our neighbors die every week. Every week, to where at the end, the complex was only about half full, and they couldn't get anybody to move in, because you're either going to move in and you're going to die, or you're going to move in and you're going to see your neighbor die. So it was a very, very desolate place to be. And I lived right next to the swimming pool, so I got to see everybody come in and out, you know, and all of that. And it was just horrendous. I had this one dear friend of mine who, speaking of friends and acquaintances, you live in a complex full of gay men. Half the people there are your acquaintances. They're not really your friends, but you do make friends with some of them. And one of them was this friend of mine named Dennis Reisberg. And we had dated a little bit, but then we decided, no, let's not date. Let's just not, you know, we're better as friends. And he called me one night to say, can you come sleep with me? And I'm like, well, Dennis said, I thought we kind of decided no. He said, no. He said, I just want you to hold me. That's all. He said, this was a former bodybuilder who was now dwindled down to skin and bones. And he said, it hurts when people hold me. He said, I just want you to hold me so I can sleep tonight. He said, nobody wants to touch me. And I didn't realize how that feeling of touch meant so much to somebody. And he was like, I just need somebody to touch me. I'm like, wow. So I did. And I got up the next morning. I went to work. And when I came back, the ambulances were at his house, at his apartment. And so I knew. I'm like, crap. You know, another one. You know. I didn't tell my family that I was positive. I didn't tell them until I moved to Boston from Houston. I moved to Boston in 1992. No, I'm sorry. Yes, in 1992. 1992, that's right. And I started getting sick when I was up there. So I went to the local clinic. And I got tested for HIV again. Even though I knew I was already positive, I said, well, I said, maybe they made a mistake all those years ago, you know, this, because I got tested in Houston in July of 1987. So I said, well, maybe they did make a mistake back then. I said, let me go ahead and get retested. Well, sure enough, the results were the same. So I started seeing a doctor. They put me on a medication regimen and all of that. And I stayed in Boston for another year, another almost 2 years, until I got so sick that I had to tell the people at work. I had to tell my boss at work, and they fired me the next day. I did get a severance package, but it was like they didn't want to deal with me. So, and I mean, these days you can't do that. Back then, you could. Nobody even questioned it, because it was like, because it was a double-edged sword, because it's like, if they say, well, why'd they fire you? I would have had to say, because I'm HIV positive. So I'd have been blowing my cover, too. So I'm just glad I got the severance package and I moved back to Louisiana. I moved back in with my mom and dad, who lived next door. You know, and I had to tell them. They said, you know, so my dad... So one day my dad asked, he said, so you have AIDS now, right? And I said, no. I said, I'm HIV positive. Yeah. But HIV positive turned into AIDS very quickly, very quickly. And my T-cell count had dropped down to about 10. And I mean, a normal T-cell count is about 11 to 1200. And my T-cell count was 10. So I had an AIDS diagnosis and I didn't even know it. So, it was difficult for my family, obviously, because I started having all of those same symptoms of, you know, skin losing weight, you know, your skin's driven off your bones, your skin starting to turn gray. If you ever see somebody really sick and their skin looks gray, that was me. I mean, you could see my cheekbones. It was really horrible. So, You know, I had to live through that. And, you know, I saw myself looking like some of the people that I had seen dying in my apartment complex. I knew what that looked like. I knew what AIDS looked like, and it looked like me. You know, so. Can we take a break? So now we're up to Acadiana Cares, right?
So, actually, yeah, you were talking about how, you were sick.
Right, I was sick and I moved back to Louisiana. Mm-hmm. So that leads me right into the Acadiana Cares.
Okay.
That's how I got involved with Acadiana Cares. Do we need to touch on something else before that?
Well, I guess you said you were very sick, and then did you get involved with Acadiana Cares right then? Or
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so let's... Yeah, so yeah, could you just...
Well, that could be your next question. So did you get involved with Acadiana Cares? Is that when you got... Yeah, so that's...
yeah, yeah.
Are you ready?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, okay, yeah. So that's when I got involved with Acadiana Cares. Now, Acadiana Cares, the backstory is, back at the beginning of the AIDS pandemic, is what it was, there was a group of people called, they called themselves Lafayette Cares, Concerns for AIDS Relief, Education, and Support. That's what the CARES stands for. You want me to spell? Concern for AIDS, Education, Relief, and Support. And they were just helping people out of the back of cars. They were bringing people food. They were bringing people blankets. They were bringing people whatever they needed. Well, as it turned out, just working from the backs of people's cars weren't working anymore. There were so many people sick, so many people dying, that they developed this nonprofit organization called Acadiana Cares, because Acadiana serves all seven of the parishes, not just Lafayette and Lafayette Parish. It serves all seven of the local Acadiana parishes. And the way I got involved with Acadiana Cares was I was a client. Or should I say almost a client. You know, doing well in the executive world is a two-edged sword. I made too much money to become a client of Acadiana Cares. Because I had worked so hard in the executive world, I made quite a bit of money. And so my Medicare disability and all of that stuff was more, you know, you have to live below a certain poverty line or something like that. And even with my Medicare disability, I made too much money to become a client. But I knew that I wanted to do something to help. It, not even helping myself. If helping others helps me, well, then that's what I'm going to do. And there was a volunteer coordinator there at the time named Bunny Andrews, who said, why don't you start to talk? She said, you know, you're a really good public speaker. Why don't you tell people your story? And I said, well, I don't think my story is any different than anybody else's. And she said, no, but she said, the problem is we don't have anybody that wants to tell their story. They didn't have anybody with AIDS that was willing to teach people about AIDS. Everybody was dying. And I figured I was dying too, so what the hell? It can't get any worse. And I started doing public speaking at little, the first one I did was in the psychology department at UL, in Hamilton Hall. I remember it was Hamilton Hall, and forgive me because I forgot the professor's name, but I would always start off the speech with, does anybody know somebody who has AIDS? And very seldom, most of the time, nobody would raise a hand because they didn't know anybody. And I said, well, now you do. Because I said, I'm standing right here in front of you. And they'd go, like, you know, like that. And I'm like, and I would tell them, you know, yeah, this is what somebody with AIDS looks like. And most of them had never seen anybody. You know, and here I was. You know, people said, oh, that was so courageous. That was so courageous. And I'm like, no, it wasn't. I said, I was scared as hell. Every time I got up to do this speech, I was scared as hell because I didn't know how it was going to be received. But after every single class, oh, wait, you might want to stop it. I'm going to get something. Okay. I'm still having out with Acadiana Cares. I'm doing all of these talks all around the state. Because of my work with the state, I got invited to be on the advisory board for the University Medical Center, which is here in Lafayette. So I was on their advisory board about how to better treat, not actually treat medically, but how to better treat on a personal level, how to treat people with living with AIDS and living with HIV. Because obviously back then, nobody wanted to touch you. So we had to give seminars, in-clinic seminars to the staff of the University Medical Center to say, yeah, this is how you should be treating our clients. You know, and so that worked out really well for me, because I got to know a lot of the other people living with HIV. Because we had a sign on the board of Acadiana Cares that just because you're in here doesn't mean you have AIDS. Because you could be a volunteer, you could be a staff member, you could be a volunteer, you could be just anybody wanting to come in and help. So they didn't want people to assume that just because you were there was because you had the virus or the bug, like we called it. So I got really involved with Acadiana Cares, doing the talks and doing all that. And then slowly I became involved with a group called the Acadiana Community Cares. And it was a group of HIV-positive individuals who worked closely with the staff of Acadiana Cares to say, this is what we need, this is what we're hoping for, this is what we want. You know, and it wasn't like a list of, you know, you got to give me this, you got to give me that. It was one of those, we were trying to be helpful to each other. Because obviously if you're living with the virus, you have a different perspective on things than somebody who's just trying to help. And what they want to know is they want to know how to help. So it was a good compromise, a good conglomeration of people that were all together. And because of that, I became the first chairman of the board of Acadiana Cares that was HIV positive. Wow. And that was 30 years ago. Wow. Yeah.
How long were you the chairman for?
I was the chairman for about a year. I moved the job that I had in Lafayette. I took another job working in Austin, so obviously I couldn't stay on the board of Acadiana Care. So I left them a note saying, "Hey, thanks for everything, da da da," but I'm moving up to Austin. So, and when I moved to Austin, I was not involved with the HIV community at all. I was totally into my work. I had gone back to work. Oh, I skipped that part. I'm so sorry about that.
That's fine.
In the meantime, while I was at Acadiana Cares, I went back to work, which a lot of people with HIV and AIDS never get a chance to do. You know, but I did. My health was doing okay, and I actually went back to work. And when I went back to work, it was in Austin. And they were fully aware of everything, and nobody questioned. So, yeah, so that's how I ended up back in Texas.
I guess I'm curious, like, what do you think changed? I mean, because you mentioned, like in Boston, like, you know, they'd fired you for having HIV, and now it's like it's all good. So what do you think changed? Like,
I think education changed. I think that's what changed, is they figured out that just because you were HIV doesn't mean that you couldn't be productive. That you could still be a productive person in life as well as in work. You know, and I'm very thankful for that. As for how it is now, I don't know because I haven't worked since 2007. I retired in 2007, so I have no point of reference for that.
Okay, and then I guess kind of going ahead, can you talk about how like Acadiana Pride formed and like what support and challenges you encountered?
Acadiana Pride started, a dear friend of mine named Lewis Tolliver, was contacted by some bar owners in Lafayette, the owners of Bolt and the owners of Tonic, Ty Hebert and Joe Spirer and Justin Menard. They were friends with Lewis, and Lewis used to work at a place called The Shed, which my brother was the manager of at the time. And so Lewis and I kind of got familiar with each other then. And when the subject of Acadiana Pride showed up, he contacted me immediately. He said, "Hey, can you come? We're going to have a meeting about Acadiana Pride." I said, "Well, what are y'all going to do?" He said, "Well, we're going to have a Pride Festival." So they knew that I used to live in Houston and Austin, and I used to go to the Prides in Dallas and Boston and all of that. So they knew that I was very familiar with Pride festivals across the country. So, so when he contacted me, I went to the first meeting, and everything was in the infancy stages. They hadn't really started hardly anything. So I came on board, and I became the vice president. Lewis was president. I became the vice president. I became the fundraising chair. I did everything from promoting the festival. I booked all of the acts for the festival. I paid all the acts for the festival. I did the bulk of the fundraising. And I say that not to toot my own horn, but I say that because we were only like seven or eight people. And everybody had their own little thing to do. So the fact that I was really good with fundraising, that just made sense for me. Even though we had a fundraising director, I was the one that was the point of contact. And I was the one that had the contacts in the Lafayette area. So it just made sense for me to do most of the fundraising. And we put together a thing called Acadiana Pride Idol, which is similar to American Idol, where we'd have a singing contest every year. And what that did is it kept the public involved in Acadiana Pride throughout the year. So it wasn't just, we're having an Acadiana Pride festival from this day to this day, please come. It was one of those where we had some type of event every single week, whether it was a bear dinner or, you know, we'd bring in entertainment from out of town to raise money. We did Acadiana Pride Idol. We did a thing, an event called Rhythms and Visions, which was for artists, both visual artists and performing artists, and they would donate their time and we would raise money that way. So every single week there was something to do with Acadiana Pride. So it kept it in the forefront of people's minds throughout the year. So it got them excited for, oh my God, the festival's finally here. The festival's finally here. And we got a lot of support from the local media, which was very surprising. We got a $25,000 pro bono from Cox Communications to do commercials for us. I mean, it was big time. And I remember having a meeting with Ben Berthelot at the Lafayette Tourism Bureau, because I wanted some money from the Tourism Bureau, because I figured if we could get the Tourism Bureau to donate some money, then we would have some kind of clout. You know, to go to other places and say, hey, well, the Lafayette Tourism Bureau is helping to sponsor this. Oh, they are. Okay, well, let me give you a little bit of money. So I remember having this meeting with Ben Berthelot, and I showed him the budget. My budget was $100,000. And I showed him. I said, this is where this money's spent. This is where this money's going. I mean, I had a spreadsheet of everything. And he said, well, what's your plan B? He said, what happens if you don't raise this $100,000? And I said, I don't have a plan B. And the next week, we got a check. He's like, and he told me later, he said, I can't believe when you told me that you didn't have a plan B, he said, I knew that you were serious. I said, yeah, and we ended up raising over $125,000 that first year. But we spent it all. I mean, people, it costs a lot of money to put on a festival. It costs a lot of money, especially 4 days. We did 4 full days of festivals for the first festival. So, I mean, that was pretty, I mean, we were kind of out there because people thought we were crazy, and maybe we were. And so for the second year, when I was president, we did the same thing. We did 4 days of festivals, and we did just as well the second year as we had the first year.
Do you know how many people attended, or roughly?
Roughly between 5,000 to 6,000 people over the course of the 4 days, because we had calendars and all of that.
Mm-hmm. Were there any challenges that you experienced?
No. I'm glad you asked the question, but the answer is no. I thought that we would have. I mean, we were getting ready. We had the police called in. We had police on guard and all of that because we thought we were going to get protesters and all of that stuff, but we had none of that. None of that. Everybody that showed up was supportive. Everybody that showed up was happy. They were just happy to be there. They were happy that we were having a Pride Festival. I mean, it was 2014 and Lafayette had never, ever had a Pride Festival before. Ever. So they were just happy to have one.
Why do you think that is? That they never had a festival before?
I don't know. I guess just no one organized it. I don't know. I don't know why there was never a Pride Festival. I don't know. But I mean, remember we grew up back in the 70s and 80s and 90s where you had gay bars everywhere. I mean, at one point Lafayette had 7 gay bars. So I guess they figured there was no need for a Pride Festival. You could just go out to the bars. Well, now in these days of social media, you have Instagram, Facebook, Grindr, Growler, Tinder, all of these, you know, apps and all of that for your phone that you don't even need to go to a gay bar to get a date. You know, so having a Pride Festival was something that we thought, well, let's do something to get people to come out of their houses and get off of Grindr and Growler for the weekend, you know, and come out to a festival. And that, I think that's what really worked. Is it was something that the people could do, that they could meet people just like they were and not have to go to a bar.
excuse me.
That's right.
Are you still involved with the Pride Festivals now?
Yes. Whitney Dorfman started up a new Pride Festival. Now, when she started it up, she had no idea that there was a Pride Festival before. They were just aware that there was... I had to step down from Acadiana Pride when this is really not part of the story, but a car had hit my house right there. And I had jumped out of bed and I hurt my knee whenever I jumped up out of bed. So I ended up having to have hip surgery and all of that stuff. So I stepped down from Acadiana Pride. And they had Pride for another couple of years after that. And then it just kind of went away. We don't know where it went away to. It just kind of went away. It just kind of dissipated into nothing. So when Wendy Dorfman came into town, she was not aware that we had already done a Pride Festival. She said, well, we need to do a Pride Festival. And I was all about it. I'm like, yes, sure. Let's, you know, da-da-da. So I contacted her during the first Pride Festival, her first Pride Festival. And I told her about the prize from before. She said, oh, she said, I didn't know. I said, no. I said, I know you didn't know. I said, I'm so excited that somebody's doing this again. So this year I was a little bit more involved, not in necessarily the planning, but I was involved because I did a book signing during the Pride Festival for this year.
Right. I actually want to briefly talk about that, but before that, is the Pride Festival, do you feel like it's like changed or evolved since the first one, or... Do you think it's more? Is there more or less?
No, I think it's changed a lot. I think it's the Pride that we have now. It's a lot more younger people, a lot of the younger generation, which I really, really love that. I don't know why my slipper keeps falling. No, that's one of the things that caught my attention right off the bat was that I noticed all of the young people, and people still in high school. And I just really, really appreciated that somehow what we did on the 4-day festival didn't bring out the young people. Maybe because I was older, and so it's most of the people of my generation that came to our Pride Festival. But the Pride Festival that they have now, the newly revised Pride Acadiana, has a lot of the younger generation, and I really, really, really appreciated that.
Okay. You briefly mentioned your book. So yeah, you've written a memoir.
Yes.
So I'm just curious. Like, what inspired you to write the memoir now?
Actually, the way it happened, what happened was that I've been journaling since I was in first grade, and mostly because the ski teacher would tell me to shut up. Because I was always being a little bit boisterous in elementary school, so she'd say, shut up and write something. So I'd, you know, just write something or other. I just started writing and writing and just compiling my journals. And one day I was sitting with my mom, and I told my mom that I was writing a book, and she said, and I was writing a book for when I died. I was writing a book so that after I was dead, everybody could go in and say, oh, Ted did this and Ted did that, and, you know, he was famous for this and da-da-da and all of that stuff. But it was very PG, or even G-rated, I must say. And my mom said, no, she said, I want to know what really happened. I said, well, do you really want to know what really happened? She said, yeah. She said, I think it's important. So I started redoing my journals and rewriting a lot of the stuff that I had written before. And it got to be fairly graphic, but I mean, not X-rated, not R-rated, but it's kind of graphic. Because the things that happened to me, and I didn't happen to anybody else. But the way they happened to me is the way they happened to me, and not the way they happened to somebody else. So I felt that it was important. My mom wanted to know exactly what happened. I said, I'm going to say what really happened. And I ended up putting up one of my chapters on Facebook. And I reached out to this publisher in Nashville, thinking I wasn't going to get anywhere with a publisher or anything like that. And like within the next day, the publisher contacted me. She said, have you written anything else? I said, yeah. I said, I've kind of written other things, but I said, it's not a book or anything. I said, it's just a bunch of my writing. She said, well, send me a little bit of what you have. So I sent her every other story, because I'm not going to send somebody my whole life story. I said, well, let me just send every other chapter, every other little story in between. And she called me back within the week. She said, oh, no. She said, I need to know what happened in between those. And so we started a book. You know, that's how I got started writing the book. And the book is called The 16th Second. And it's about everybody having 15 seconds of fame in their life. Everybody, no matter who you are. And you can decide what fame means for yourself in your own life. But what happens in the 16th second? What happens after your 15 seconds of fame are over? What do you do then? You just go, holy crap, I got to start this all over again. Or what do I do? You know, what do you do with the 16 seconds? It's literally the rest of your life. And so my book is about how I took my first 15 seconds of fame and made the next 15 seconds of fame mean something different in my second life. And now I'm working on my third life.
And, you know, after having finished it and published it, like, how does it feel? Like,
I feel exhilarated that it came out. I feel exonerated because I know that a lot of people, all of my life, I would tell people stories about my life, but I always stopped at a certain point because I never wanted them to know what really happened after that. This book gave me a chance to tell them what really happened after that. And so now they, all of my friends, my true friends, have a better understanding of, oh, this is why this happened. Oh, this is why he did this at this time. Oh, this is why. Oh, now I understand. You know, they have a much better understanding of who I am as a person. And these are my good friends who I had been lying to my whole life. Well, not lying to them. I just wasn't telling them the whole story because their whole story hurt. And now they know the whole story. And they're like, holy cow. They said, well, like, I wish you'd have told us. And I said, no, I said, I couldn't tell you. I just couldn't, you know. So, yeah. So, I mean, I feel, I guess exonerated is a good word, but it's not the best word I can use. It's just the only word that's coming to my mind right now. But it makes me feel better knowing that other people know the true story about, oh, now it all makes sense. And I'm glad that I'm glad that my friends can understand now why I never told them the whole story back then. Okay. And we became closer friends.
Okay. And then just as a excuse me, as a final question, excuse me, how do you feel things have changed for the LGBTQ plus how do you feel things have changed for LGBTQ plus individuals in Southwest Louisiana, and what work do you feel still needs to be done?
That's a difficult question. Because sadly, I think that not much has changed. I still see the bullying going on within the gay community, as well as outside of it. I still see the same cliques forming in the bars. You have the lesbians over here, the muscle-bound bears over here, the pretty boys over here, you know, the fatsos over here, you know. And I'm using those terms because that's the terms that they use, not because I feel that way on a personal space. I still see people that hate drag queens. I see people that love drag queens. You know? I have to say that RuPaul's Drag Race made a big impact on how straight people view drag queens. So I think that, I guess that's a positive thing that I can say. But as for what I see when I go out into the gay bars, I don't see that much has changed. I don't see a whole lot of community. I see a lot of community at the Pride events. Like when Pride Acadiana holds an event, I see a lot of community there. But as for in general, I don't see a lot of community. And I don't know how to describe this community like that. One thing that I wish, that I think needs to change, one thing that I got involved with a group of people called Equality Louisiana. Equality Louisiana, and also a group called Forum for Louisiana. And they do a lot of work with the legislature to get bills passed that help the LGBTQ plus community. Not only the LGBTQ plus community, but also they work with Louisiana trans advocates. They work with a lot of other nonprofits to get laws passed that not only show equality for LGBTQ plus people, but equity for LGBTQ plus people. And that means two totally different things. A lot of people don't understand that equality does not mean equity. You know, we want equity. We want the same as everybody else. We want the same opportunities as everybody else does. And even today, I find that LGBTQ plus people are not getting the same opportunities as the straight community. And that's especially vocal in the trans community. I think a lot of people in the LGBTQ plus community forget that T stands for trans. You know, and they are part of our community also. So I think a lot of things, I think that's where a lot of work needs to be done. I also think that, you know, I look back at my time when I was younger and I knew nothing about the legislature. I mean, I knew about voting. We learned about voting and civics and all of that. But I never put into practice that voting had something to do with being LGBTQ plus. In my older generation, now I know I need to go vote this person out of office, go vote this person into office, vote for this amendment, vote against this amendment. You know what all of these things stand for. One of the things that I wish the younger generation would get is the importance of their vote.
Do you see like any hope or optimism with regards to that with the younger generation?
I do. As a matter of fact, at the last Pride Acadiana event, I spoke for a little bit, and it was a large group of young people, and I told them, I said, you're always asking me what do we wish for the younger generation? And I said, I wish the younger generation would vote. And I said, I'm not telling you how to vote, I'm just saying have your voice heard. And when you have your voice heard, you'll know what voice needs to be heard. And that's gonna come from your heart, and you're gonna vote your heart. Anything else?
Yeah. Well, really, just is there anything else you wanna that we haven't discussed? That
read my book.
Definitely. All right.
All right. No, I think we've touched on everything, Zach. I think that we've come along. As much as I say things have not changed, things have changed a lot. But there's still more change that needs to happen. So I guess that's what my closing line would be, was that, you know, even with change comes more change, and that change is needed.
Okay. Great. Okay, I'll stop the recording.